It's 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and as always, it's time for Office Hour. You're listening to 90.3 FM. And before we begin, as always, the views that are contained in this hour may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So, 5 o'clock on Tuesday, Office Hour, this is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And as we always do at 5 o'clock on Tuesday, we knock on someone's door. What are people doing in all of these big buildings on campus today in the rainy, cold day? What are they thinking about inside their offices? What are they arguing about? We're public university. So here we are, part of the face of the public university to the public. And I'm very pleased today that we are knocking on the door of an old friend of mine from many years at Davis, Julie Z from American Studies. So welcome.
Thank you for the invite.
So we're going to be talking about her work on sustainability and environmentalisms and all kinds of interesting stuff. But as always, when we begin the show, we always start off with the same question, which is, how does someone come to be a professor of American Studies? Which I imagine is something some of our listeners don't even know what it is. What is American Studies? It sounds sort of like American history, but not exactly. So maybe you can tell us, how did you become a professor of American Studies, Julie?
Well, pretty haphazardly and randomly. I started off, I think, I became interested in environmental justice as an undergraduate at Berkeley. Mm. And I took a class called Race, Poverty, and the Environment with, he wasn't a professor, but it turns out he was very well known within the environmental justice community in the Bay Area. He's an architect named Carl Anthony, and he was the founder of an organization called Urban Habitat. And he, for some reason, was teaching this Race, Poverty, and the Environment class. And I was kind of blown away by it. I had already had interests in ethnic studies and peace and conflict studies, which were and I was an English major, but those were sort of my, you know, places I got my sustenance. Mm-hmm. You know, taking classes on nonviolence and classes from leading Shakespeare scholars and ethnic studies scholars, like people I didn't know who they were at the time. And then I found out they were, you know, the founder of ethnic studies in, you know, et cetera, like Ron Takaki. I took a class with him. So I was already interested in issues of culture and the humanities. I was an English major, but I was also interested in racial and social justice. And like many people as undergrads, you kind of come across a book or you go into a learning, living community, and your position starts to change from how you were raised. So I think for me, I came from a very working class immigrant background where I was supposed to be a certain type of person. I was supposed to go to college and become a doctor or a lawyer.
Something useful.
Engineer. I certainly wasn't expected to go to Berkeley and become an English major, you know, and to take ethnic studies and peace and conflict studies classes. And one of the beautiful things is because I went to a public university at the time I did, you know, my parents didn't have like leverage over me. It wasn't like they were like, you need to do this or we won't pay your tuition. You know, there wasn't a lot of debt that I had to face down, you know? So sure. I had the luxury of just being like, you know what? I like these classes. They have meaning for me much more than the idea of sort of becoming a lawyer did. Mm-hmm.
What drew you? I'm just curious. What drew you to English literature, do you think?
I think some amazing professors. I mean, I had a lot of amazing professors at Berkeley in large lecture classes. I had very few small classes, but they were kind of masters at what they did. Mm-hmm. And so I actually, that's a great question. I actually don't even remember. I think I took a class with, I took some ethnic literature classes. I mean, I was fundamentally always interested in sort of race, immigration, and identity. Mm-hmm. And I think I took some of those classes, like, you know, the scholar Viet Nguyen, you know, who won the Pulitzer. And, you know, he was like my TA. He was an English PhD at the time, you know. And so I think I just had these transformative learning environments at Berkeley. Mm-hmm. Some of them were grad student instructors and some of them were professors kind of doing their big, you know, thing mm-hmm. in ways that kind of blew my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I still vividly remember classes that are not connected to anything I do now, but being completely captivated by them, you know, mm-hmm. like a drama class or a literature of the French Revolution and, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you did your own version of GE, right? But
yeah.
It wasn't dependent upon the rules. It was just trying to take a lot of different courses.
Yeah. I mean, I think I did have to do the breath thing, but, you know, I was really lucky because, I mean, I didn't know who Leslie Kirk and Eric Gruen were, that they were like amazing classicists and, you know, but I ended up in their class of 1,000 people and they were incredible lecturers. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think I was kind of lucky. I mean, that's the thing. It's like you're 18 and you have no idea that this is like the world's leading expert on, like I had Janet Adelman, who's a big feminist Shakespeare scholar. I had no mm-hmm. idea who she was.
She was wonderful.
You know, Barbara Christian was a teacher when I was there, you know, all these amazing faculty.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So
you were lucky, but you did also take a breadth. You took a very broad mm-hmm. view. So I think that just want to point that out to any students who are listening to take the very broad view. And then, but we haven't really figured out how you got into American Studies. Was that after you really graduated when you were going to your graduate career?
Well, I took this race, poverty, and environment class. I mean, you know, I took an ecofeminism class and I thought ecofeminism, half the class thought it was economic feminism and the other half thought it was ecological feminism. So the class was very funny because it was bifurcated by people who were sort of like, you know, they wanted to professionalize and sort of be, you know, career corporate women. And the other half were like, you know, hippie types, you know, but it was a great class. And the woman who taught it was an Australian ecofeminist. Mm. And she taught some amazing, like pedagogically, she just really had this like pedagogy that was, you know, opened my mind, you know, like including writing, you know, I kept a journal, like 100-page journal about a plant, a chili plant, you know, and I grew up in New York, you know, I didn't know what I didn't have a sense of like nature or the environment. Of uh-huh. course, New York is its own. It is an environment, but it wasn't anything I understood. I go to Berkeley and there's all these like, you know, like hippie things. They're brand new to me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? I read Carol Adams' book about her eco-feminist book on meat. And that kind of, you know, blew my mind and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of reading in those areas, you know, gender and meat and ethnic studies and... So then I took this race, poverty, and environment class. And luckily, I was part of a context in the 90s, which I didn't know about at the time. Because when you're 18, you don't understand your life within these moments historically.
Mm.
But I didn't have to pay very much for my undergraduate education. But B, there was this moment in the 90s that environmental justice was becoming more organized and more mm. real. So actually having taken a class on race, poverty, and environment made me very, like, you know, interesting to the organizations that were starting to hire in environmental justice. So I did some anti-toxics work in Boston. I did some internships in other places and so on, like with Union of Concerned Scientists. But having that academic background, because, you know, environmental justice and race, poverty, and environment wasn't like a very big thing.
Yes, so, I can imagine. Most people probably didn't know what you were talking about.
Right. And so being somebody who knew what that topic was as these organizations were starting to do that kind of work was helpful. And it didn't matter that I was an English major because I had taken classes on race, poverty, and environment, and that made me know more than most people.
Right.
So I went and I became, you know, it was May of my senior year. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And somehow I saw that there was an organizer position in New York with the New York Environmental Justice Alliance. And I applied. And again, because I knew what environmental justice was, you know, I got the job. And so I was an organizer for a couple of years.
In New York?
In New York. I'm working on different kinds of campaigns like diesel bus, you know, air quality, transportation primarily. And then I realized that there was a problem for me, which was that I didn't like that there was only 2 weeks of vacation a year. You know, like May would come around and I'd be like, okay, now I'm ready.
Yeah.
Like for something.
Because of all those years of going to school. Yes. It's gotten you in a habit.
Yes.
And the vacation habit.
And I was like, wow, I have to just keep on working. I don't really like this, you know, but I really did. I learned a lot. I was working up in Harlem. It was an incredible experience. And some of the people that I met, I'm still right with some of them, you know, I'm still in touch. And so on. So for me, I didn't want to go to grad school to be a professor. I, in fact, didn't know what that meant. What I knew was that there were certain kinds of questions that I wanted to ask that could not be asked within the parameters of community organizing.
Give us an example of a couple of those, because I think that's very helpful when I talk to students and they're trying to figure out which way to go with their life. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I ask them to think about is, what are their important questions? Mm-hmm. And do their important questions lead them into an activism way, or they feel that there are other ways they have to go in order to answer questions that are important to them?
Right. I mean, so for me, to give you an example, a lot of the work in New York City at the time that my organization was working on fighting for to move the fuels in the New York City bus system from diesel to natural gas, which is less polluting.
Right.
And there, the one of the questions that you could never ask is, why are 7 out of the 8 diesel bus depots in Upper Manhattan, in Harlem, in a primarily Black, at that time, Black community?
Mm-hmm.
That's not a question you can ask in an organizing context, you know. But it was a question that was interesting to me because as someone who had studied ethnic studies, I was like, I want to know why.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how did it come to be that these 7 out of the 8, they're cited? There's such a strong concentration between place, race, and pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was not a question that you can ask, because organizing is about, like, you know, you have to get people to a hearing. You have to, you know, do testimony.
Practical.
It's practical. Mm-hmm. And I had historical and cultural questions that I wanted to ask. And that there's no space for that as an organizer.
Mm-hmm. So that drove you to apply to graduate school.
I applied to one program, NYU American Studies, because the culture of that program was, and I think still is, very scholar activism oriented. So my cohort had people who were labor organizers, people who were native sovereignty people who were involved in like anti-gentrification work, anti-police violence work. And so for me, it was a space where you could do the organizing and the scholarship together.
Right. I was thinking about that. You didn't actually go that far from your scholarly roots. From your activism roots, but it gave you an opportunity to ask complicated kinds of questions that might involve spending a lot of time at the library and not necessarily at a hearing or something like that.
Right. And so for me, you know, they're the common sense, like, answer of, like, why there are 7 of the 8 diesel bus depots are in Harlem is because it's zoned that way. You know what I mean? As if that kind of had a no history to it, like it was just a fact. And I knew that that wasn't true. I mean, it might be true that that's the way it's zoned, but that there was a much more interesting story about how that zoning came to be. And so I was lucky enough, I worked with Andrew Ross, who's coming here in May. And, you know, he is and remains very committed to scholar activism of all kinds. And so for me, it wasn't to go to grad school to be a professor, and it wasn't to go become a professor of American studies. It was because I was a scholar activist. I wanted to do this, what people call scholar activism, you know, and that's that it happened afterwards. I found out that American studies has a long tradition of that.
Mm-hmm. But it isn't, I mean, I'm wondering, do you see that as being a problem or an opposition in some way to, you know, in other words, is it a problem if you're going in to be a scholar activist to end up in an American studies department? I mean, I don't think it's turned out to be a problem at all. It turns out, as you say, it's part of a tradition in American studies. Mm-hmm. And there's many scholar activists of all kinds of types in academics.
Right, right. No, it's not a problem, you know, but I'm explaining that it wasn't very conscious.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't very planned out. And I always, I feel sort of bad when I talk to students, because it seems like there's, what I try to tell students when they ask me, you know, how I ended up here, or like they're at that crossroads in their life, like they're about to graduate and they don't know like whether to do this or to do that. And what I say, you know, is that when you're living your life, you don't see it as a narrative. Like that this is going to lead to this, that is going to lead to this. This makes sense. You just are living your life. Mm-hmm. And then it's only with the benefit of, you know, the hindsight that I can say, oh, well, my activism on campus is what helped me with this. And this is why this is the political commitment. And, you know, that matters to me. I didn't understand, you know, when you're living your life at these crossroads, you don't see how it's going to play out.
That's true. But what's interesting to me is that you do have a very strong thematic consistency in your life, which is your and which was one that you also found in part in exciting undergraduate classes, which is the question of sustainability. And that leads us then to now all these years later, as a tenured faculty member in American Studies here, you're still asking those questions that you were asking as an undergraduate, which is that intersection between environment and sustainability and race. So I want to turn to the first article of yours that I want to talk about, which is a piece that comes in your recent book called Sustainability, Approaches to Environmental Justice and Social Power, which is NYU Press, where your alma mater, in 2018. And you kind of start off very similarly to the question that you were raising before that kind of flummoxed you when you were a young activist, which is how come there is such a strong correlation between industrial pollution patterns and residential patterns? So that's a question that still interests you. So maybe you can talk a little bit about sort of how we start to begin to understand or just to pay attention to that there's a lot of facts on the ground that we don't always notice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a sociological way to ask that question, and many quantitative sociologists have tried to, you know, tackle that question. I think this is where the English background and the ethnic studies background shape how I approach the question differently. So sociologists and quantitative folks are kind of like trying to show the evidence of the disproportionality, or there's this whole debate about like, well, did poor people go where pollution is, or did pollution go where poor people go? And for me, like, that's not, you know, is it race or is it class? Like, it, you know, that's not the way that makes sense to me. And it's not what makes sense to justice activists on the ground. Like, they don't see those in that way. It's more connected to history, and power. And so I think the disciplinary question of how you handle these or interdisciplinary approaches is a common thread in my work. So even with this more, this area that seems more scientific or pragmatic, like I want to tackle it in a slightly different pivot. You know, I don't want to just ask and answer it in this kind of quantitative, what I think is a more narrow way. I like busting it open and asking it more, like in a bigger timeline and in more different ways into it.
Well, give us an example then. I understand what you mean by saying you're not interested in it, in the question of the residential pollution patterns as being primarily a quantitative question. You're not going to send people out with little maps to measure the darkness of the smoke maybe or something like that. So what would you say? You use the word from English. Would you say that there's a narrative that interests you around this, and that you're interested in a certain kind of way in which this is a story that we as Americans tell ourselves as an American studies type way? Is that what you would say differentiates your approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, yes, narrative is a big part of it, because I think environmental justice, when the movement got named as such in the 80s, what it was trying to do was to change the narrative of environmentalism. And it was trying to change it from one that was more wilderness focused and more white and conservationist, and to really take in, you know, more issues of race, more issues of industrialism, more issues of gender, more issues of settler colonialism and native peoples. And so environmental justice as a movement is a narrative reframing of environmentalism from, it used to be called in, you know, the 80s, like mainstream environmentalism versus environmental justice, you know. And now environmental justice has sort of suffused in mainstream environmentalism. So that divide doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, there's still some power imbalances that are legacies of that. But when I was coming up, you know, in the 90s, like that's how people were talking about it. There's mainstream environmentalism, which is like Nature Conservancy, Sierra Club, kind of like the Big Ten, you know, they're based in DC, they deal with policy or land acquisition versus like a more community-based, health-based or race-based environmentalism kind of from below.
So if we were talking about sort of standard environmentalism, what those groups would be doing, they would be making sure that there was a mountain somewhere that, for example, white middle-class people could go on the weekend.
Right.
And that's what environmentalism would be.
Right.
Sort of weekend activities, trips out, making sure that the trash was picked up, that the roads were not put down in places that they didn't want to have, you know, roads and stuff like that. And then on the other hand, that's, and you say that was sort of a standard way of thinking about environmentalism. But in environmental justice comes and asks a different question, which is more about the stories about race being not just environmentalism being something that affects everybody and some people much more, particularly based on race. And it's not about what you do on the weekend. It's about, I would say specifically in this article, you make it a lot about air, the air that people breathe. And that's not something we do on the weekends. That's just all the time. So you talk about one story, you talk about breath as black geography. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about that in terms of how that story of it really shapes what you think of as environmental justice.
Yeah, I will. I'll talk about that in a second. But I wanted to also say that that divide between the sort of mainstream narrative and the widened narrative, it's pretty old in the U.S. So, and this is work that comes from environmental historians, not necessarily environmental justice people, but people like William Cronin, who talk about, you know, the wilderness and the frontier and the development of the U.S. as being, you know, part of this heroic narrative of, you know, Teddy Roosevelt is the iconic, you know, masculinity, and, you know, he makes
guy out with his gun on his horse.
Exactly. Right? And, you know, it's all tied to colonialism and Indian, you know, killing Indians and, you know, cowboys, all that kind of stuff. So that there's like a strong violence, you know, and masculinity thread, strong ties to the eugenics movement and so on. So, you know, you could put that, it's not just in like the 60s after, like the mainstream environmentalism. You know, it really has its roots to like late 19th, early 20th histories. Teddy Roosevelt being like the most iconic example of it. But anyway, going back to the question of black geographies, that's not like my field, but I use that field in thinking about that work. I've been working on asthma for a long time. It was a huge part of the New York work. I was just telling the lecture I just came out of that I was just looking up the data, you know, for that article that's in the book. And child asthma rates in New York are 6.9%. And the asthma rate for children has been going down steadily. But for black children in certain neighborhoods, the black child asthma rate is over 25%.
Wow.
You know, and so this question of, you know, like when you see the I can't breathe that Black Lives Matter has, you know, that's a direct quote from Eric Garner when he was choked to death by the police. He, of course, had asthma, obesity, hypertension. The coroner's report said he was murdered, but said that his pre-existing health conditions contributed to it. And so I think, you know, in environmental justice activism in the 80s and 90s, when I was there, there was a huge debate about what this child asthma rate is from and how you deal with it. And so, you know, the kind of more narrow view of it is saying, oh, well, there's genetic predisposition. You know, some people are more vulnerable. And the activist always said that it's about our exposure.
Right.
You know, it's about our exposure because we're near highways, we're near these diesel bus depots, we're near pesticides, you know, whatever, what have you. And so that becomes this political, you know, question.
I think it's quite, I mean, I don't know how optimistic you were trying to be when you brought your history of this environmental opposition between sort of standard environmentalism and then environmental justice. Saying that, because I can imagine that the Teddy Roosevelt guy going out and doing his hunting, he doesn't really care about asthma levels in New York City, right? You know, it's just not part of the same story. But you did say, and so I want to just go back and really pick up on that point you made, that the environmental justice movement has become much more integrated into standard environmentalism today. So we don't see that bifurcation as much as we did in the 80s. I think that's a very optimistic thing to say. And I'm I'm struck by that. And I'm curious if you want to tell us a little bit about how you think that happened in terms of realignment of groups of deciding what's important about a clean environment.
Well, I think that it's more complicated. You know, I'm very close to Elizabeth Jampierre with UpRose, and she will always continue to say that mainstream environmental groups are trying to extract labor and knowledge and work. And so it's not like everything is fine.
Heaven forbid.
Yeah. But there still is a lot of struggle, you know, between groups about resources and claiming credit and all this kind of stuff. You know, that's, so I just want to like make that clear. It's not like everybody's, you know, on board and, you know, with the same agenda. There still are strong conflicts between different sectors. I mean, as all movements are. But I will say the reason why I want to be mildly optimistic is because I think things do change, and we have to talk about how things can change, because otherwise you just get into kind of a narrative of like nothing ever changes. It's all despair. So to give an example, when I was kind of growing up in environmental justice, the Sierra Club came within a hair's breadth of having a eugenicist white supremacist slate elected to the board of directors. And part of it was tied to, you know, there was a lot of anti-immigrant environmentalism at the time.
Yes.
The idea is, you know, people are going to come and become Americans and, you know, be used too many
ruin
resources.
Ruin the environment.
Exactly. You know, misanthropic kind of environmentalism. And, you know, they lost the election, this slate, like barely. And then in 2016, Sierra Club passed a pretty strong solidarity statement with Black Lives Matter. So, I mean, I think that discourses do filter through. And I think, you know, some of it is probably genuine belief, and some of it is probably strategic, you know, resource, like getting more resources for your work. And, you know, I mean, I think it's not all cynical and
oh
bad,
yeah. Oh
know?
Yeah. I agree totally. Having just following it in the press, I think there is just concern among the environmental community to be more aware of these issues. I think they're trying to educate themselves.
Yeah.
So you talk about something called inclusive sustainability, which I think is a very interesting idea. Sustainability is one of those big words that everybody uses all the time. And I'm not sure people really know what they're talking about when they use that word. But when you say inclusive sustainability, you're looking for, you say, practices that begin from an understanding of political economy and histories of racism. So that when we're talking about, I guess the bottom line is, what do we want to sustain? Everything,
right.
We don't want to sustain everything just because the word sustainability sounds good. But maybe there's things we don't want to sustain, like racism in the environment and things like that. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what is inclusive sustainability?
That is a good question, because I probably should have reread the chapter. I will say that your point about sustainability being so vague as to have no meaning is something that I'm trying to talk about in the book, like to offer in the introduction a genealogy of that's usable, because sustainability is not a term that existed, you know, in the 90s when I was working and I was a student. And then now you see this growth.
Everywhere.
Everything is sustainability. So it's a word that demands some care for that, you know, genealogy. And this is where the literary and the cultural analysis come in. And I'm not the only one who's done that. There are other terms like resilience, you know, that are also very easy to co-opt and kind of be ever-present, because basically it is whatever you want it to be. These are terms where there's a lot of projection going on.
Yes.
Know? And then there's a lot of like, we can be sustainable and capitalist, you know, or we can be consuming sustainability. And so I think the task of the book is to say that sustainability has to have some kind of clarity in terms of its politics, and it has to have some kind of clarity in terms of its interdisciplinarity, because otherwise it'll just be, you know, a hegemonically science policy term.
Or we'll be sustaining things like racism. It'll just get swept up in the things we want to sustain.
Right.
Well, terrific. We have come to the end of the first segment of Office Hour today. So we'll take a short break from some announcements, and then we will be back in just a minute. So welcome back to the second segment of Office Hour today. This is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and I am talking with Julie Z from the American Studies Program about her work on environmental justice. So I wanted to start the second segment with a very simple question, which because I was so interested in how you wrote, you raised this briefly in your article in the book Sustainability: Approaches to Environmental Justice and Social Power, which is, what is nature? What is nature in the first place? So this seems like if we're going to be talking about environmental justice, we should have some idea of what nature is. Just very briefly, in the book, you talk about nature. Different people have different ideas about what nature is. And I would certainly say environmental justice takes a very broad notion of nature in terms of even being the natural environment that people live in without it necessarily being what we would think of as being, for example, wilderness. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, as we said, I was trying to argue before, environmental justice was a narrative challenge to the hegemonic conception of environmentalism. And environmentalism and the role of nature and wilderness in it is that's a cultural and a narrative question. Like, what are the terrains of what it is? The environmental justice movement said the environment is where we live, work, and play. Mm-hmm. And then it's gotten expanded to be where we live, work, and play, pray, are incarcerated, go to school, and so on. Mm-hmm. That there are many places that constitute the environment for environmental justice groups, including Asian Pacific Environmental Network in Oakland and Richmond. You know, they have school counselor campaigns to have bilingual counselors, and they call that an environmental justice issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, well, I think that's quite striking, and I think it's just interesting to listeners to think about the expansion of the term environment. It makes a lot of sense, since actually, when you're talking about something like air, we breathe all the time. We don't just breathe. And I also appreciated the point you made there that what we call natural or wilderness or open spaces often were spaces where people used to live. So I thought that was an important point in the article. It's just we got rid of those people, and now it's pristine.
Right.
But that to just be aware of that, I think that's part of the legacy of us as University of California, just to remember that an open space was inhabited by other people at some point.
Right. That's why I really enjoy reading environmental history with geography. Those are kind of my two favorite fields to read in, even though those aren't my fields. But there is a book called Dispossessing the Wilderness by Mark Spence, and he talks about the iconic American national parks, Yosemite, Glacier, Yellowstone, and basically that native removal is what had to happen for the national park system to be created. And so that takes us back to Teddy Roosevelt. So Teddy Roosevelt, you know, was founder of the national parks. I mean, he was also very invested in, you know, the mythology of the West and going to overseas, and the famous pictures of him as a hunter, you know, in Africa with the killing big game. You know, those are all part and parcel of the same kind of idea of control. I think that's a lot of it. And a lot of the ideologies of the settlers was that, you know, native people didn't use the land in productive
correctly
ways.
Right,
so, you know, that was sort of the justification
for taking them and getting rid of them, because you're returning it to nature in a better form. Well, I think that's a really good point, so I just wanted to make sure we got that on the show, even though it's a somewhat small point in the article. I think the final really big question for me, and I realize this is another complicated question, which is, how do we then try to develop models of change or whatever that take all of these stories into account? In the article, you talk about gentrification with both the example in San Francisco, the Hunter View, the Bay Point, Bayview Point, Hunter's Point, am I saying that correctly? And then the one in New York, Industrial City, arguing that the attempts to gentrify there and to bring in business is displacing people, and it's sort of like a repetition there where you get rid of the people who are there and then you try to build something up. And I think there are a number of people who are very concerned about these questions. I think these issues are widely debated, discussed a lot. But I wasn't sure, how do we figure out how to do it better? How do we learn how to make bring in the changes or whatever needs to be done for communities in a way that doesn't just displace the natives, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a question that is very important, and it's something that I've been kind of struggling with mm-hmm. for a long time. And I think there's a couple of there's this great piece by about teaching climate change by a colleague of mine named Janet Fiscio, and she talks about talking against sustainability solutionism as an ideology, like, because that's what students want to do. They want to come and solve the problem, you know. And she's saying, actually, what we need to do is to make more problems and to be on the ground and sort of, you know, force a kind of reckoning with history that is just too easily, you know, swept away as universities really want to brand as sustainable spaces or, you know, create the next generation of neoliberal managers of environmental resources. This is a big question at Davis because we graduate hundreds of people in the environmental sciences and environmental policy, and there's almost no attention to environmental justice in those in the mainstream approaches to environmental policy. And I think that's dangerous because if you don't talk about ideology explicitly, then it just becomes this naturalized thing. And so there's a lot of people who work on environmental justice on this campus, but they're not sort of in the core, like environmental policy and planning, environmental management, et cetera. There are people in Native American studies, community development, American studies, and so on. So I think for me, the question of solutions is a really fraught one. I'm not actually that interested in solutions unless we can even begin to have a conversation about what the scope of the problems are.
Mm-hmm. Well, if
that makes sense.
It does and it doesn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, as somebody, I mean, one of the things you talk about in your book, the other book, Fantasy Island, mm-hmm. You talk about something called that you call eco-authoritarianism, mm-hmm. which is where people just sort of, you're trying to be the far end, the opposite of that, from what I understand.
Yes.
That eco-authoritarianism is where, you know, an authoritarian government like the Chinese just mm-hmm. comes in and says, no, you have to, you can't have these plastic bags. And it's mm-hmm. done because there's an authoritarian government mm-hmm. that puts the ecological principle forward. And so what you're saying is you're not interested in that kind of solution
right.
because that's authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter that they've gotten rid of that all. But I do wonder, I mean, the example I thought of when I was reading your book is California and high-speed rail. Mm-hmm. You know, that the Chinese have high-speed rail, mm-hmm. and it looks like ours is now going down the tubes mm-hmm. this month. So I understand, I mean, I think that there's a moment of nostalgia about, wouldn't it be nice if we could have a high-speed train in mm-hmm. California? So is there a problem in California that we don't have the right narrative, that we haven't mm-hmm. told the story correctly enough? I mean, I don't want to turn it into an authoritarian thing, but it does seem that we do spend a lot of time on other discourses that sometimes just make it difficult to do anything. I mean, one of them being the demise of it seems like the high speed rail is going to mm-hmm. go down the tubes. And the other one is housing, which also mm-hmm. is something you talk about. And I'm interested in it. We used to make poor neighborhoods. Maybe it wasn't very good, mm-hmm. but we made poor neighborhoods in the 60s and the 70s. Mm-hmm. And we don't make poor neighborhoods anymore mm-hmm. as a state. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions is there a story that we need to tell that will help us deal with how we do things, or how in this case we simply don't do things no matter how important they become? I feel there's a kind of immobilization around action.
Well, I think that you ask some really important questions. I would say for me, hearing what organizers on the ground are proposing is where I'm guided from. So Community Water Center, Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, a bunch of water justice activists in California were able to support the passage of a human right to water bill in California. And, you know, there's a lot of policy debate about what that means to implement a human right to water. It's not, again, an uncomplicated story, but it's still very significant that it passed as law. There's a lot of water insecurity in California,
yes.
you know, including, you know, 162,000 people don't have access to clean water, and tens of thousands have to buy all of their water a la Flint. And so I think there are organizations that are really trying to think of very concrete policy solutions. Mm-hmm. So I am guided by their work often because they, I think, are proposing policy responses. So I'm not saying that policy doesn't matter. But what for my work as someone who is not a policy expert, but I'm more interested in social movements and the construction of movements, the point that you're making about how we talk about things and the histories that are buried and how we can talk about those histories and how they inflect the present is what my contribution is, mm-hmm. more than a policy one. But not that I'm saying that policy work is irrelevant at all. The example, I think the moment that we're in right now, this is coming, some of what I'm saying is coming from a book that is going to come out in the fall called Environmental Justice in a Moment of Danger. And what I'm trying to argue in that book is that we're at this crossroads of danger, mm-hmm. that is very intersectional, to use that word. It's many dangers, you know, but that those dangers are connected. So climate change is connected to anti-immigrant and anti-refugee stuff, connected to a regressive gender politics. It's connected to authoritarianism, the authoritarian turn globally, not just in the U.S. But that environmental justice has always been a very intersectional movement, mm-hmm. so that we can look to environmental justice movements as a freedom movement that is trying to provide some kind of guideposts through the moment we're in. Because it's like there's so much stuff going on right now, like LGBT abortion, movements against abortion rights, and you know, retrenchment of civil rights and voting rights, and so it can feel overwhelming.
Absolutely,
it's this Hydra-headed thing, but that's what environmental justice movements have been fighting mm-hmm. for, depending on how you periodize it, either decades or centuries. Mm-hmm. They fight the Hydra-headed nature of all these beasts. Mm-hmm. And I think the value and how environmental justice is a freedom movement is to say that this narrative and this political moment we're in, structured around greed, neoliberalism, market forces, there's something wrong with it. Mm-hmm. And that there is there's something more than that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the book, in my introduction, I quote from Langston Hughes, his poem, Kids Who Die, in 1938, which, mm-hmm. you know, got a lot of circulation after Trayvon Martin was killed. You know, this is the day after the Stephon Clark non-prosecution, you know, and also the social movements around that. And there's this moment in the poem where he talks about, you know, the kids who die and the old and the rich will live a while. You know, and they will eat the blood and gold. And so what I try to, and I don't have the exact quote, it's an amazing poem. And the environmental justice movements are trying to say, like, we can't eat our young and we can't eat blood and gold and oil. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something wrong with that. Mm-hmm. That's not a vision of how to live. And you know, going back to the conception of nature, I'm really impacted by the work right now of Raj Patel, who writes a lot about food justice, and Jason Moore, who's like a world systems Marxist ecologist. And they wrote this book called The History of the World in Cheap Things. And cheap nature is their first thing. And cheap nature is what enables everything afterward. So they talk about the cheapening of food, the cheapening of work, the cheapening of care. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of other ones. Those are the ones that I remember. But I think that environmental justice is basically saying that we can't cheapen life and nature anymore. Mm-hmm. Like that's not okay.
And it is interesting that it starts from nature. I think that mm-hmm. does lead you back to many of the points mm-hmm. you were making throughout our discussion today. But I do want to just see if we can follow up again to clarify for everybody. You're saying that there's a kind of familiarity to the situation that we're in now, to certain groups who've been fighting the problems mm-hmm. we fight now. They're used to them. They've been fighting them for a long time.
Right.
That's just that the rest of us are noticing
right.
now that these are problems. So if you were going to try to characterize for our listeners, what is it that they know? Is it primarily, you know, what is it that this hard-fought knowledge that the that mm-hmm. has been gained by groups because they've had so long fighting over these issues, is it primarily around sort of like the center of the message? Is that, in other words, that there is something at the core and you start, mm-hmm. when you're feeling overwhelmed, like mm-hmm. where many of us are feeling today, you go for this core, and this core is sort of how you think about nature, and that that's part of the message that they're giving to us, would you say?
Right. I mean, I think that that's exactly the point. And, you know, I just came out of this lecture in my colleague's class, and I was talking about Kivalina, which I think is in the introduction of the sustainability book. And this is, you know, one of the 400 Arctic indigenous villages that are currently being washed away by climate change. So this is like current, not future stuff. And it's not just the Arctic, it's also Pacific Islands, Caribbean, et cetera. So it's a very concrete way in which sea level rise and climate change is impacting now certain communities who have basically no responsibility for the problem, but they're bearing it first. And so the in Kivalina is interesting because they sued the oil and gas companies for the damage that was happening to them. They filed this federal lawsuit, and it was thrown out in the Ninth Circuit. On the idea that this was not a legal question, it was a political question. And so Kivalina is interesting because of this lawsuit, but it's also the words of Colleen Swan, who's one of the leaders in Kivalina, are really, really quite powerful. And, you know, I highly recommend, like, if you Google, you know, Colleen Swan, you will hear her. And she basically says this, you know, which is like, we have been fighting since the doctrine of discovery. Like, we've been fighting 500 plus years, you know, and we have to restore environmental justice. Restoring means we take the lead, you know, Native people. And it's quite a powerful, you know, statement. And so I think the overwhelmingness, you know, is an indulgence that some people have because you can be insulated from the immediacy of different pollution or damage or violence. And many people are not insulated from that, primarily Native people, African-Americans, you know, and so on. And so for me, hearing the words of activists who connect their struggles with 500 years of colonialism, you know, is a way that you can understand like the temporal scope of what we're talking about, you know. And then it helps. Then there are also other things that are going on. There's an interesting lawsuit where children are suing the Trump administration around their climate policy. And, you know, so I think that, you know, everybody has to be involved in the fight.
Yes.
Because we're getting to that point where everybody's being affected, you know, in ways that it was easy to have this kind of canary in the mine. Like environmental justice said, oh, we're just canaries in the mine. We're the first people. We're the front line. But this is going to be everybody's, you know, problem. And now with wildfires and drought and sea level rise impacting many places, not just small island communities, but major cities like Osaka and Shanghai, Hong Kong, Mumbai, this is not a fight that, you know, can be a marginal one. It has to be everybody in as many ways as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, that goes back to your point about the being a combination of a scholar and an activist. I don't know how you would tell or if you would tell a student who came to you who asked you not so much about where to go in life, but how to balance mm-hmm. those issues. I think that's something that many of the students I know live with on a daily basis. You know, how have you managed to find a way to operate balancing off? Because you worked for a while, and then you decided you wanted to go back to school and ask those long-term questions. So, and you write books, you sit in the library. I mean, so you do the academic version as well. How would you recommend for young people to think about that question about how much should they be, you know, how do they prioritize the academic part of themselves in a time when it feels like activism, as you say, that many-headed hydra seems to be drawing so many people's attention?
Yeah, I mean, I think that any advice I give is completely irrelevant because the situation and context in which I came up is not what our students have to face.
Hmm.
And I have a lot of sympathy for that. And so I think, you know, asking my students, I try to always ask them, like, what would freedom look like for you? You know, what would freedom from debt, like, what would you do? You know, and so that they may not be able to operationalize, like, be an, you know, art studio major, you know, because they feel this pressure. But, you know, even asking that question, you know, creates a space where you can just kind of, you know, be reflective. And so I try to just create spaces where you can ask different kinds of questions and sort of be thoughtful. And so I think I try not to give advice because my advice is so irrelevant to the material realities of people now. I think that there's a lot of students who, you know, work a huge amount, and I think that they have to face a lot of issues, including like existential threats or the psychological affect of, you know, growing up with climate change. I can't even imagine what it's like. I can't even imagine what it's like to be a young person now with, you know, the political situation it is. You know, I think that I have the luxury of my age, mm-hmm. which I appreciate more every day. And so I think that it's important for students to understand their interpersonal feelings, their affect within the structure. And I've been starting to read Mark Fisher, and he wrote a book called Capitalist Realism. And he wrote a book about haunting and depression. Yes. And he is trying to talk about like the affect of neoliberalism. And so I think that what it's really, I think many students that I see are very impacted by neoliberalism as their entire reality. That's the entire life of which of their existence has been under a regime of neoliberalism. And I was talking about Hurricane Katrina in the lecture I was just at, and you know, the students were, I think, 5.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about that. Yes.
And so their entire lives have been under this regime. And so it can be overwhelming, but that's what neoliberalism is.
Okay.
It colonizes your head.
Okay, well, I'm going to just, on behalf of the listeners out there, I know there are listeners who are sending me psychic messages that are saying, okay, you got to stop Julie right there, because there are people who live in the world that don't understand what the word neoliberalism is. And there are people out there. And so, since I've got you here, I'm going to make you tell me what that term means, because it's used a lot in academic discourse. And I think that the students don't really understand what that means. And so that's central. You're saying that that's central to their worldview. So we're going to take a moment and you're going to explain it.
Okay. So a neoliberalism is a economic ideology that has been dominant in the U.S., but also in other places like Chile. And basically the idea is that the market sphere is the best sphere for making decisions, and it should be the market and private sector over the public sector, privatization and deregulation, which is basically taking out the state from regulating. And so these are kind of free market doctrines that valorize the market over other ways of being, which, you know, in solidarity, unions, public sector, regulation, Keynesianism, whatever. So neoliberalism is the dominant ideology globally. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, the moment we're in also is a reaction to neoliberalism.
Yes.
So the, you know, anti-immigrant, so like free trade and globalization is like all neoliberalism. And so when you have Trump and Bolsonaro and, you know, all these like Duterte and all these other authoritarians that are like, we need to be nationalist and close our borders, that's also a kind of a response. So that's kind of the moment we're in right now.
Right.
So, but basically where it comes, I talk a lot about neoliberalism in education, you know, because I tell my students, like, my tuition was $800.
Yeah.
A year.
Right.
And that was in the 90s.
And they say, are you 150 years old?
Right. And, you know, I came out of college without debt, and their mouths just drop. Or I'll say that, you know, my students, and it's not just a historical thing, but it's also, you know, in other countries, higher education is free.
Right.
You know,
right. Well, if we're going to, because we're coming to the end of our conversation today, I like to ask our guests to leave the listeners with a thought question. You know, sort of coming out of all of your research now, what are you thinking about? And sort of as the next question, and what would you leave for them as sort of a question to mull over in the next while?
I think that is, I should have prepared a question better.
Well, you can pick any of the ones that seems to me you've got many questions floating in your mind. So what sort of like, what's the leading edge next for you? We've talked about stories mm-hmm. coming from the environmental justice movement and local knowledge coming mm-hmm. from the environmental and how important that is to give us more of a historical scope.
Mm-hmm. I think the question I have is like, how can people make meaning in non-market ways? And how okay. how can you have art and love, even if you're a shitty artist, you know, and music in your life? And what gives you meaning right now? And what is freedom for you? Mm-hmm. And that we need to think about these things like every single day, because part of the sphere of the moment we're in is to just, you know, be angry and, you know, upset. And we should be. But part of what that is doing is colonizing our mind again mm-hmm. from thinking about things like love and care and solidarity.
So you want to get that all out of the mind, everybody's mind. So your thought question for people is, what could you do maybe this evening to uncolonize your mind yes. and right this moment go and have fun around singing lessons, something like that.
Right.
Don't be productive. And certainly don't be economically productive.
Yes.
Right. That's the message we're ending up with our interview today. Do not be economically productive. Don't get sucked into the capitalistic machine. Do something else for the evening. So this interview will be archived, as always, all on officehourucdpodcast.com. So everybody can listen to it again. And when it is archived there, it will have a link to Julie Z's website on the American Studies website there, your website, so people can find more information about your publications and they can read it. So I want to thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for the invite.
Yeah. And we will be back next week with something new. We'll knock on somebody else's door. So we hope that you join us then. And in the meantime, I guess the point was, enjoy yourself and decolonize your mind. We'll be back next week.